Mr. Solomon, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm on the line, sir.
Thank you very much. This is Chair of the Committee, Bill Bennett. I'm a member of the Legislative Assembly here in British Columbia, representing the constituency of East Kootenay, which is over in the southeast corner. Cranbrook is the largest center in my area. I think I should perhaps get my committee members just to introduce themselves so you know who's sitting here today, starting with Ben Stewart.
Thanks very much. Ben Stewart, member for Westside Kelowna in the Okanagan Valley.
John Slater, MLA for Boundary, Similkameen, and part of the Okanagan Valley.
Rob Fleming, MLA for Victoria Swan Lake and Deputy Chair of the Committee.
Scott Fraser, MLA, representing Alberni Pacific Rim. Welcome, Keith. Thank you.
So, Dr. Solomon, I understand you're at the University of Guelph?
That is correct. I'm a professor emeritus. I supervise grad students, do research, and have been here at the university since 1978.
Well, 1978, I graduated from the University of Guelph in 1976 with my undergrad degree.
So too bad. I didn't get a chance to mark you.
I missed you. That's okay. I wouldn't have taken any courses from you. It would be too hard for me. I went on.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Anyways, thank you for your time here today. You have 30 minutes, and typically presenters have taken anywhere from 15, 20 minutes to do their presentation, and then we have time for questions. Regardless of how much time you leave for questions, I'm sure that we'll have lots for you. So why don't you just proceed?
Yeah, okay. Is Mary there?
Morgan.
Or somebody to advance the slides?
Morgan.
Yes, we have our committee researcher at the ready.
Okay. So is the first slide up?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I will just call out the slide numbers as I move from one to the other. So the first one is just introducing me and the title. The next slide, slide number two, just to remind you that, there's a lot of information available about pesticides, and this is a book that Jerry Stevenson and I co-authored on pesticides in the environment. So lots of the information that I'll be presenting is in fact taken from texts such as this one and others. We move to the next slide, slide number three. The pesticides are used for a large number of uses in food and fiber, but they're also used for what I would call aesthetic uses. So the image you see here of a dandelion-infested boulevard is something that some people don't mind and some people don't like. And if we go to the next slide, number four, pests can do very significant damage to our aesthetic spaces, our own gardens and public spaces. You can see damage to lawns here, and there's some birch miner, which will do damage to birch trees. And you can see fungus, bottom right, skunk damage, top right, and chinch bug, top left. And all of these cause damage that is difficult to prevent other than with the use of pesticides. You can replace the grass, or you can use some other techniques, but the pesticides are often more effective. If we move to the next slide, this is just a picture of a home garden and an inset at the bottom right of a painting by Vincent van Gogh. And both of these are aesthetically pleasing to people, and people are willing to pay money for paintings by famous artists, and also obviously to make their gardens attractive and give them a pleasant environment to live in. Slide number six, if we can move on, is just a by law, anything that controls a pest is defined as a pesticide. But within the class of chemical pesticides, there's a vast range of substances which have very, very different biological and physical properties. There's a couple of photographs there. There's an insecticide, top right, and then you probably haven't thought about it, but the disinfectant that you use in your toilet bowl is in fact a pesticide. It kills bacteria and is actually registered as a pesticide. So we still use these routinely in our houses even in places that have enacted bans. They obviously cause effects in the target organism, otherwise you wouldn't use them, it would be a waste of money. Some are fairly toxic to non-target organisms, and some are basically essentially innocuous. So there's a range here, and that's the important point. Not every pesticide is highly toxic. Not every pesticide is highly dangerous. If we move to slide number 7, pesticides to be used in Canada must be registered. And in order to register a pesticide in Canada, you have to take to the Pest Management Regulatory Agency in Ottawa a large amount of data that shows that the pesticide, if used as written on the label, will not cause any adverse effects or risks to either the environment or to humans. And this is basically the same process that is used in other countries, such as the United States, the European Union, member countries, and then also in many other international jurisdictions who often use the auspices of the World Health Organization for their risk assessments. And this data that is reviewed is current as well as historical data, and it's regularly updated. The 2,4-D review, just as an example, was recently completed in 2007, which was a re-review of a product that had been looked at for many years over and over again, and it is still registered here in Canada. An important point about these studies is that all of them must be done now under what's called good laboratory practice guidelines, which means basically that they are done according to standard protocols and that there is a quality assurance and auditing process in place that actually ensures that what people say was done in these studies was in fact done. And just to remind you that the Health Canada, which is the mother agency for the PMRA, is also the agency that approves use of pharmaceuticals in Canada. We move to slide number 8, just some pictures to remind you of the kind of testing that's done. This is rats are often used as surrogates for mammals, and for environment they might use birds, such as the bobwhite quail on the bottom left. And there are many, many studies that are done with these, and this data is then used in assessing the risk of the pesticide. So slide number 9, the next slide shows fish being used in toxicity testing for chemicals, and this kind of data is used then to assess impacts or potential impacts on organisms in the environment. So the focus at PMRA in Ottawa is both environmental and human health, and to make sure that there's protection in both these areas. If we move to slide number 10, testing data is reviewed by the regulators, and this is either PMRA or other parts of the world, and they use what I call the precautionary approach to set guidelines for exposures for humans. So they use safety, or what we like to in the science call uncertainty factors. So if you find that a chemical has no effect at a certain concentration in a rat, then you would say, well, for humans, we will only allow an exposure to one-tenth that concentration, because obviously humans aren't rats. We'll add another uncertainty factor or safety factor of 10 times, because we know that some humans are different from other humans. So the sort of basic safety factor that you see for pesticide exposure is 100-fold from the most sensitive animal tested for the most sensitive endpoint. And then in addition to that, there may be additional factors added up to 10. So you multiply these together, it's a 1,000-fold safety factor. And this would be in relation to exposures, say, for children who might be deemed to be more sensitive. And from all of this and application of these uncertainty factors, the acceptable daily intakes are calculated here in Canada, and in the United States they use a different term for that, which is reference dose. And they also develop environmental exposure guidelines. Go to slide 11. At least in home and garden use, most pesticides are actually very non-persistent. they only have short-term effects on target organisms, and the reason, that's the reason why they often have to be used more than once in a season, and why you get rapid reinvasion by weeds and insects. Certainly for herbicides, these generally have very low toxicity to non-target animals because they're basically designed to control plants. Of course, they will damage plants if they're deliberately sprayed on them, but that's the reason why you might use a herbicide. We go to slide number 12. When we look at hazards from chemicals, we're really looking at two issues. One is toxicity, and the other one is exposure. And the overlap between these two circles, and if somebody presses the space bar, you'll see the word hazard appear there, is the hazard. So the larger the exposure, the larger the hazard, the larger the toxicity, the larger the hazard. So we use toxicity data and we use exposure data to assess risks from pesticides. Slide number 13 shows two herbicides, 2,4-D at the top and then MCPA, a similar product. And on the right are the toxicity values for rats and mice. These are the most sensitive values. So these are not very large numbers to compare them to something perhaps that you're all familiar with. Table salt would be lethal at 300 milligrams per kilogram. So these materials are less toxic than table salt. I'm not suggesting you use them on your fish and chips, but just to put it in some sort of perspective. But natural doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. So if we look at the natural product, which is indole butyric acid, which is the hormone that these two herbicides mimic, it's found naturally in plants, and we're exposed to it when we eat plants. This is actually several times more toxic. We need less to achieve an LD50 for this product than we would for the synthetic product. And then this is across the board. Some of the fatty acid products that are now recommended as substitutes for herbicides are, in fact, much more toxic to frogs than the herbicides that they're replacing. So we don't necessarily always move in the correct direction. Slide number 14. There have been a number of exposure studies done. They are required for registration in applicators, such as farmers or professional applicators. There's a requirement for food monitoring and a requirement for water monitoring in Canada for pesticide residues. We go to slide 15. We've done some work in our own labs here where we've looked at exposures to herbicides sprayed on turf. This picture shows the turf spraying. And if somebody will click the advance there, you can see the people involved in exposing themselves to this treated turf after it's been sprayed to measure the amounts that get into the body in that process. And we go to slide 16. These are the conclusions. In none of these cases did we see any numbers that would be of concern. And in addition, the reentry periods of 24 to 48 hours basically reduce exposures to negligible amounts. These were reentry periods that were in use in Ontario at the time this research was done. Slide number 17 just quickly gives the genesis of the ban of pesticide use in Ontario, and this was a report by the Ontario College of Physicians, which made some conclusions about linkages between pesticide exposure and diseases in humans. And if we go to slide number 18, there's some issues with this report. First of all, it's based only on epidemiology. Many studies were omitted from their report. It didn't consider the toxicity data that PMRA and other agencies use, and it didn't consider the exposures, and it didn't consider the published regulatory reviews from PMRA and the US EPA and other agencies. In terms of epidemiology, slide number 19, epidemiology is the study of diseases in humans. They're good organisms to study, but we are extremely difficult to work with because we don't always do things or we don't always say what we do. And these studies are really based only on correlation and suggested links, and they cannot establish causality on their own. And the pictures there are some of the famous people who were involved in the linkage between smoking and lung cancer, which is a pretty definitive fact now. We go to slide number 20. I've told you that the Ontario College of Family Physicians report was not very well done, but others have done the same thing, and these people are not even from Canada, so I don't think there's any axe to grind here at all. But the UK Advisory Committee on Pesticides basically said that this report didn't raise any new concerns, and there was no reason for additional regulatory action in the United Kingdom. We go to slide number 21. There was another opinion on this report from the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution, and the quotation in slide 22 from this is that basically the strong conclusions were being drawn from evidence that was of very weak quality. And then if we go to slide number 23, there are other opinions on pesticides and cancer from the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And if you click the slide to advance that, there's really a lack of evidence linking pesticide exposure to human risks of cancer. In Canada, in slide 24, age-adjusted cancer incidence rates have remained constant or decreased for most forms of cancer. Breast and prostate cancer have increased. Some of this is because of lifestyle issues. The other parts are improved. Better diagnosis. There's no evidence of any causal link between pesticide use cancer and childhood cancers have not increased in Canada over the last 20, 30 years. Just finish up slide 25. Should domestic and landscape use of pesticides be banned? As a scientist and speaking as a toxicologist, there are no toxicological or health reasons for this. If you want to do it for political reasons, that's fine. That's within your mandate. But if you do that, you should be honest to admit that you're actually doing that. Consider the countervailing risks. There are certainly increased costs related to either the actual cost of the alternatives or the lack of efficacy of many of these, which means they have to be applied more often, and this increases cost as well. And the alternatives are not themselves without risk. I've mentioned the issues with fatty acids and being lethal to frogs. Obviously, if we use pesticides, we should use them properly. And the best way to do that, I think, is something that British Columbia pioneered over the years, which was to ensure that integrated pest management was used to make sure that all the options that are available are used. And in slide 26, I'm thanking you, and I'll be more than happy to take any questions. I did supply some reading material if you want to ask questions on that as well. I'd be happy to try and answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Solomon. We do have some questions. I'm going to actually ask a question. I'm curious to know what you have to say about the interaction of, and I'm going to look for the term here while I'm asking the question. We've heard that the application of pesticides is an issue that, in fact, there may be evidence that the consumer doesn't follow or not even necessarily understand labels, and that therefore they're not applying the pesticide in accordance with the instructions on the label. Is it your view that the studies that Health Canada does and the risk assessment that they perform takes into account the consumer that doesn't use the product in accordance with the label?
Obviously, they can't anticipate every single possible situation. So what they do is they look at the label and they use that as a guideline for how the chemical might be used and what the exposures might be. But one should also recognize that at least for homeowners, and I'm not talking about professional applicators that have appropriate training and know how to do these things properly, but for homeowners, the products that you can buy over the counter are usually in very small packages, less than 1 kilo or 1 liter. They're often in ready-to-use applicators that make mixing unnecessary. And the toxicity and environmental properties of these products is such that even if you did make a mistake, it would be very unlikely that you'd cause any harm to either humans or the environment, even if you, say, put it on twice instead of once or whatever you, whatever sort of error you made.
And can you, just a second and final question, can you give us your thoughts on the issue of cumulative impact from the use of pesticides over a period of years? And I'm talking about the common, you know, garden, lawn and garden pesticides. And while you're at it, when you're thinking about the issue of cumulative impacts, could you also perhaps address the other issue of synergistic impact? You know, multiple kinds of pesticides applied in a on a space or in an area, and whether there's we know what the impact might be from the combination.
Yeah, I will perhaps the best way. I'll start with the first question, which relates to accumulation of these materials in the environment, and once again, the products that are used in domestic situations, you know, the insecticides or the herbicides, all of these degrade rapidly in the environment, so they do not build up over the length of the season. In fact, you know, the weeds come back fairly quickly. Within, you know, at least for 2,4-D, you have to apply it both in the spring and the fall to get good weed control, because the weeds come back. So the chemical is going away fairly quickly. The half-life of 2,4-D in soils is a matter of weeks, and some other products dissipate extremely rapidly. Glyphosate, Roundup, is gone, no longer biologically active within hours of being sprayed on soil. So there is no accumulation over time. In terms of synergism would be an issue, and is an issue with, say, pharmaceuticals, where we take two drugs and there's an adverse interaction between them. But remember, we're taking them at high doses that are designed to cause adverse effects or beneficial effects in us, you know, kill bugs or treat the symptoms of a disease. So with the pesticides, the exposures are really so small that there's no effect. And synergism requires that there be at least an effect for one chemical in order for an interaction to occur with another chemical. And it also requires that they actually, the exposures be within a very short time frame of each other. So they're either together or within hours of each other for there to be sufficient probability that there'll be two chemicals present in the organism at the same time. But in fact, the amounts of exposure are so small that they're below any threshold of biological activity, so there's actually no risk of synergism.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. MLA Fraser?
Yeah, and thanks for the presentation, Dr. Solomon. You did refer, I think, to some of the studies done by doctors in Ontario, and I want to refer to that because we did get a presentation yesterday by Dr. Kathy Vacco, based on the review of the medical literature looking at human health effects of pesticides. That was done for the Ontario College of Physicians. And so their statement was that we looked at over 100 studies and found that there was very strong evidence that pesticides cause birth defects, infertility, neurological diseases such as Parkinson's disease, and a number of cancers, including childhood cancers, including leukemia. Following that, we had a presentation by Dr. Bruce Lamfer, and he went specifically to the issues of developmental neurotoxicity in children and went through a fairly substantive presentation on that and the clear links between that and exposures to pesticides. And so your position seems to be sort of polar opposite of what they've come up with, and they claim the propensity of the studies certainly indicates the links are there. And then I would just refer to the European Union, because you've referred to it several times, but the Framework Directive on Sustainable Applications of Pesticides requires their member states to minimize or ban pesticide use in areas used by the general public. That includes sports grounds, like even golf courses and public parks. So again, their studies seem to be affirming decisions being made throughout Europe now, which I assume will include Great Britain, which you also cite. So I just wanted to know if you could comment on some of that.
Yeah, Great Britain is not part of the European Union with regard to pesticide regulation.
No.
It's not part of the European Union, period. So I don't know if there would be any. But I do know the framework directive, and the major focus there is on protecting water resources. Europe is a very highly populated country, a lot of agriculture close to human activity, and they want to just minimize exposures. But when you look at the actual risks, which is what the Advisory Committee on Pesticides, what the International Agency of Research on Cancer, what PMRA, EPA, and others do, there are no obvious and serious risks. The fact that the Ontario College of Family Physicians came to this conclusion, certainly based on all the reviews of these studies that they conducted, is because they selectively took information that supported their claims and that they actually totally ignored all of the data on toxicology. Epidemiology is not a very exact science. If you look at the birth rate in Europe, it's declined in proportion to the numbers of European storks, which is a true fact, but it doesn't mean that storks bring babies. That's a conclusion that it makes no biological sense, and I think that's what scientists reviewing this data have come to the conclusion as well, that when you look at the toxicology, it doesn't support these kinds of linkages.
Thank you for that. Could you speculate on the motives of the Ontario College of Physicians, family physicians and such, to jury-rig the results, you're suggesting?
Well, no, they didn't jury-rig the results. They just selectively cited the literature. And they had produced some pamphlets in the past before they did this study where they said that, pesticides were harmful and various other things. But they actually had no data to back it up. So this was, I think, an attempt to provide that data. And they went to the Laidlaw Foundation, which supports these types of causes, and got some funding to put together a team to address this. But they were very selective in the data they used. The PMRA, US EPA, and others look at all the data. They don't just look at the epidemiology or just parts of the epidemiology. They look at everything, and they come to a different conclusion when they look at all of the information. If you went to a court case and you only heard from the prosecution witnesses, you might come to a different conclusion.
Thank you. MLA Stewart?
Thanks very much, Dr. Solomon. I just want to preface the fact that as a farmer and somebody that has watched the trends in terms of pesticide safety improve over the years, I often am wondering or expecting people that I know that I've farmed with for the last few generations to be subjected to all sorts of issues such as cancers and things like that. And I guess I'm wondering, being that, many of them seem to persevere and go on to very long and healthy lifestyles, is there any research, being that you're in the heartland of agriculture in Guelph and where a lot of these, is there studies that you're aware of that are showing signs to these people that are highly exposed? And I think about the days of when respirators and protective clothing were not the norm in terms of the way that farmers used to apply a lot of what I would consider to be far more toxic chemicals, and the outcomes of, in terms of their lifestyle. I guess the thing about it is we're talking about cosmetic pesticides. You yourself referred to the prepackaged sizes, the controlled size, and what we have done. And I guess what I'm saying is that are the people that we're talking about trying to protect, are they, in your opinion as a toxicologist, taking the extreme of the farmers that have used what I would consider to be inappropriate and poor handling procedures by today's standards. Are there studies that are showing high incidence of, morbidity and other things like that in terms of their exposure versus people that have been, you know, just homeowners working in their gardens?
Yeah, the first of all, from the work we've done on homeowners and the work that's available on farmers, homeowners are exposed to much, much smaller amounts of these chemicals, if at all, than are agriculturalists who use larger quantities, who treat much larger areas, et cetera, and have a much, much more opportunities. They may do this for several days at a time to get exposed. A homeowner might only spend 30 minutes or less doing any spraying in their garden, and they do that very infrequently. In terms of, you're right, farmers in Canada tend to have longer lifespans and actually have fewer, a much lower incidence of most cancers when you compare them to city folks. So, you know, part of that may be because they have a healthy lifestyle, they're more active. Whereas city folks are more sedentary, and that exposes you to risks from all sorts of things. Farmers do have a high incidence of melanoma, which is skin cancer, which is directly linked to exposure to sun, so I guess pretty logical to figure that one out. But certainly the studies that have been done, particularly in Saskatchewan, where there's a really good database on cancers, because every cancer case in Saskatchewan goes into a central database in Saskatoon, and they can do very good analyses of this. And Health Canada did this. Don Weigel, who works for Health Canada, did a study there and actually showed the incidence in farmers was far lower than people in Saskatchewan from the cities. So, you know, I agree with you. Farmers seem to be much healthier, despite the fact that they use pesticides.
Okay.
Dr. Solomon, it's MLA Bennett here again. We're pretty much out of time, but I just quickly have you heard of the study that was done in the of farmers and people who apply pesticides in an agricultural setting in the U.S.? There was in the last couple of years, I think there was a massive study in the U.S. on this topic.
Yes, there's a so-called ag health study, agricultural health study that's being run in the U.S.
Yes,
and it's looking. It's a follow-up study. It's looking at exposures on the one hand and disease conditions on the other. There's a similar one actually in Ontario. It's being undertaken here out of headquartered in Toronto, but focusing on Ontario, on people in Ontario at the moment as well. That's an ongoing study. It'll be interesting to see what the final results are. But some of the, again, the epidemiology studies are difficult to interpret in the short term. One has to wait till the studies are finished. And one of the most difficult things to do with these is to quantitate or quantify exposure. And the measurements of exposure in the ag health study are actually not that frequent. So it's not going to be as easy, perhaps, as some people hope it will be to interpret that study.
Okay, thank you. Last question will go to the Deputy Chair, Rob Fleming.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. I just wanted to ask you maybe to comment on some testimony that we heard from Health Canada. The PMRA in their presentation outlined their methodologies and how they operate as a regulator, and made the point that almost all of their data is from industry self-testing, their own products, peer-reviewed science, but not independent. And that's what Health Canada relies on. I wonder, just in light of your presentation, we have a whole host of products that were once certified as safe by our federal regulator, that the ingredients were safe, that have changed over time, that have been pulled from the shelves based on updates of the science of those active ingredients. But often the update of the science has been pressured by what you, in your concluding slide, maybe would define as political reasons. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that, the lack of independence sources for the research on the ingredients that Health Canada has to tell Canadians are safe, and how ingredients are have actually typically been removed. You cited the example around proven links between lung cancer and smoking, and we know how many decades that association took to prove, and we know how many billions of dollars were spent litigating against the ability of the federal government to take action on that. And I would just ask you to comment.
The smoking issue, of course, is the reason that there's so much money involved that it, you know, that overrides everything. The amount of money involved in domestic pesticides is probably very, very small compared to the agricultural uses, which probably represent 95% of the profits of these companies. Going to the issue of the testing being done by the companies are required to provide this data to the agency, in order to get that data, they pay either contractual labs, laboratories, or they do it in house in their own labs. This is all done using very careful checks and balances, and there'll be a two DVDs worth of data that will be given to PMRA with all the raw data on there, and PMRA can go through and reanalyze the data if should they wish to do that. And in fact, EPA does do that quite often. So the companies make money from selling these products. So it's probably entirely appropriate that they should pay for the testing. It shouldn't, in my opinion, come out of my tax dollars. And I think most people would agree with that. And we pay for it when we buy the product, as we do with pharmaceuticals. Exactly the same rules apply there. The testing is done by the companies, and the approval is done on the basis of reviewing those tests and all of the quality assurance that goes with those tests. Not a huge difference there. And if we were to move that into the public sector funding for this kind of research, we'd have to fund the money from somewhere. And so there'd probably be tax increases. I don't think the public would take to that too kindly. In terms of products coming off the market, certainly some of them, 2,4-5-T herbicide was banned in the 70s because it contained a contaminant called dioxin that was only really discovered at that time. The DDT was banned in Canada in 1969 because it was causing problems in wildlife that they did not understand until that time. So yes, this has happened. A lot of products get replaced in the market by less hazardous or less risky products. So many of the products that have come off the market have been basically come off the market because the companies say, well, we have an alternative that either is more effective or more or safer to use for the environment or human health, and therefore we want to switch to this product. So we're going to not renew the registration on the previous product, which results in a withdrawal from the system. So in terms of products, it might affect a lot of products at the commercial level, but in fact there are not a huge number of active ingredients, which is what are registered at PMRA that are impacted in this way. So I don't think it's quite as big an issue as some people think it is.
Dr. Solomon, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it, and that's been very informative.
Good. My pleasure to offer anything, and if you need further information, please don't hesitate to contact me.
We shall. Thank you very much, and have a nice day.
Yeah, thank you.
So, committee members, we're going to recess for a quick lunch.